Welcome to Poetry from the Jungle. Come in, sit down, let go and close your eyes. The Jungle, a preface and explanation of its findings. Introduction. The Jungle is a curious work and its provenance something of a mystery that I hope this edition will go some way towards illuminating. Many scholars, not least mine own at the Department of English Literature at Marshall College, have commented that it is not a poem at all, or even a reliable history. Fortunately, as an academic specialising in Old English dialects and English colonial lexicons, and not poetry, or even literature or colonial studies, it is not my place to enter such debates. But why, you might reasonably ask, is someone like me involved in this work at all? And what exactly is this work? The two questions are intertwined. The Jungle, and that is not its real title, as you will learn, is not a complete piece of writing. It is missing parts. How many exactly, we cannot really know. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Let me begin at the beginning, relatively speaking. The Buchanan Smith Archive. The manuscript was discovered amongst the papers of Lady Margie Buchanan Smith, a Scottish landowner from Bolerno, south of Edinburgh, who died in 1901. Buchanan Smith was well known in her time for her crossbreed shorthorn cattle, which later went on to produce the beef for which Scotland is now so famous. But she was also a collector of antiquarian papers and left a considerable, albeit largely uncatalogued library to the Montrose Library. There it sat, still in its original boxes until 1932, when T. Jerome Mockett, later Professor Mockett, discovered the trove of documents and set about cataloguing them for the library. The Mockett Catalogue. Many interesting first-hand accounts were revealed by Mockett's careful cataloguing. The diaries of Captain Graham Lorry being probably the most famous, written as they were over the period of the later Napoleonic Wars. The diaries capture in vivid detail what life was like for a merchant ship ferrying trade from the East and West Indies through seas swarming with French frigates. As we know, Lorry's diaries later went on to inspire the Hornblower novels written by C.S. Foster. Lorry would later go on to create a not inconsiderable scandal by his marriage to Coco Desire, the natural daughter of the French pretender Bianca, the Duchess of Orleans Bourbon. Scandal, it seemed, ran in that family, for Lorry's son Dominic became a notable London buck and partner-in-arms of George Brian Beau Brummel. The Jungle, and I will call it that for the sake of convenience, was one of the many manuscripts for which Professor Mockett could find few details. A bill of sale still attached to the manuscript showed that it had been bought by Buchanan Smith from Desmond Truscott, an antiquarian bookseller then based in Edinburgh's Lawn Market, in 1884. The Rutland family. From that small ticket, it is possible to trace a likely provenance to the Rutland family, who had for several generations been tenants of the Langold Gillows, the eminent 18th century furniture makers who later built Leighton Park near Slackhead in the Lake Districts. The Rutlands were tenant farmers of the Leighton Park estate. The last of the line, Katerina Kennedy Rutland, married Rupert, swashbuckling younger son of the watercolourist and poet Sir Simon Langold Gillow, who famously met his end, aged 98, when out sketching Scarfell Pike in a snowstorm. Katerina Kennedy Langold Gillow, née Rutland, was widowed early after Rupert Langold Gillow came off the worse in a local duel. She spent the years of her widowhood living at Leighton Park, taking a particular interest in rescuing the famous Herdwick sheep breed, introduced into the air by Vikings, and later immortalised by Beatrix Potter. But in her time, they were almost extinct. She left her own papers, which included the complete papers of the Rutland family, to the Library of Leighton Park. The Langold Gillow Library. When eventually, in 1854, Sir Stephen Langold Gillow came into the baronetage, the Leighton Park Library was sold off. The new baronet, a member of Cardinal Newman's Oxford movement, was interested in theology and kept behind only those books and papers that related to his particular interest. The rest, including a complete set of Orbiton's famous Birds of America with its now priceless illustrations, a 1297 copy of the Magna Carta, a handwritten copy of the Furstenberg Sonnets, the original manuscript of Ich Trüm by the German romanticist Beate von Heisenzahn-Hirschheim, an unpublished section of Milton's Samson Agonistes, and most interesting of all, an original, if damaged, printing of one of the three contested quarto editions containing the comic play Fair M. This play has, of course, long been attributed to Shakespeare due to a book found in the library of Charles I, in which this play was bound, with two others under the title Shakespeare, Volume 1. Its actual authorship is unclear and remains much debated by scholars. The Edinburgh Collection. Truscott's purchase of the library was a sensational commercial coup. On the proceeds of which he was himself able to build a large, elegant house in Edinburgh's New Town, designed by Ralph Holden, then a young architect much taken with the neoclassical styles of his day. The mansion is still standing to this day in Moray Place. Holden would go on to create many more famous structures in his career, the most famous of which are the multiple follies he built for Cosima, the Duchess of Doddrell, at Coningsby Park, and Gabriella, Countess of Kennedy, at Wickham Cross. Buchanan Smith was a regular customer of Truscott's, a buyer of his more obscure and no doubt much cheaper documents, amongst them several Lytons. From the Leighton Park Library. But if all of this traces the provenance of the manuscript backed with reasonable certainty to the Leighton Park Library, it does not explain how it first came to be gathered among the Rutland papers. The connection to Robert Knox. For the connection of Rutland to Knox, we have to go back to December 1680, when a scion of the family, Archibald Rutland, returned to his family's farm in Slackhead after an exile of almost 22 years. Archibald Rutland had been the companion of the more famous Robert Knox, a soldier imprisoned by the King of Kandy in 1659 after their ship ran aground in Ceylon. 16 surviving crew members, including Knox and Rutland, were captured and transported to Kandy, capital of the last independent king of the island, and kept in captivity until two of them, Knox and Rutland, escaped to 16 surviving crew members, including Knox and Rutland, were captured and transported to Kandy, capital of the last independent king of the island, and kept in captivity until two of them, Knox and Rutland, escaped to Dutch-held territory near Jaffna, somewhere between 1679 and 80. From there, they were able to make their way back to London. Knox wrote his famous account of the captivity he and his shipmates endured, a historical relation of the island Ceylon, which was published in 1681, originally by Nathaniel Harrison, a London printer. The book would go on to become part of the inspiration for Daniel Defoe's Robinson Crusoe. Rutland, however, remained silent, leaving behind no papers of his own and dying soon after returning home to Lancashire in May 1681. But although he seems to have written nothing about his tropical ventures, he probably left many documents behind that related to it. It cannot be known for certain that this is how the manuscript of the jungle ended up in the papers of the Rutland family, but it seems safe to surmise that this must be the only logical explanation for how the manuscript of the jungle was recovered. It had been brought to England by Rutland from Ceylon. A collection of old manuscripts. Several other papers dating to the same time and place were also discovered amongst the Buchanan Smith archive. They include the partial diaries of Roger Gold and Ralph Knight, who had also endured captivity in Kandy, letters written in Dutch appearing to come from the office of the then governor, Ruy van de Groot de Jon, a memorandum from Samuel Pereira, the Dutch military governor of Apru Fort in Jaffna, a tally of slaves signed Max Vivica Engerstrom, notes written in Dutch, English and Portuguese, many in poor or partial condition, from European settlers, soldiers and administrators who lived in Ceylon between at least 1659 to 1679, and also the journals of Susan and George Middleton Frithy, early planters from Otto Degera, whose other writings help scholars validate the complicated royal politics of the last descendants of the Cotte kings. Works undertaken by several undergraduates, most notably Dom Frith, later a colonel of the Blues and Royals, the philologist John Lightpurkis, and Karen, later Dr. Hilliard, all then working for Professor Mockett, translated most of these documents, finding them to be letters, bills, memoirs, guides, and observations about the island of Ceylon. The Lanky dialect. Where the jungle differs from these other manuscripts is that it was written in a form of Lanky, a spoken dialect widespread in Lancashire until roughly the start of the 19th century. Lanky was one of the most distinctive of Northern English dialects, an intermingling then with Old Scots, which was then widely spoken across the border region of England and Scotland, with many words and expressions common in both vernaculars. Few people then could read or write, and the Lanky dialect, as it is studied today at the English Language and Linguistics Faculty at Marischal College, is mostly of the spoken variety, using a corpora of texts that have been gathered by academics and transcribed over 120 years, and in particular, the corpora assembled by Dr. Amina Hussain and Lady Olivia Reynolds during their groundbreaking audio recording tour of northwestern Lancashire in 1984. As such, it is extremely unusual to find any document originally written in Lanky. To do so would have required the writer to transcribe phonetically his or her unique understanding of the spelling of spoken words. But this, it appears, is exactly what the author of The Jungle did. An encoded text. The written text of any such document would necessarily contain many identifiable words in standard English, but to anyone, even an Englishman reading it, it would, as a whole, be largely incomprehensible. In choosing to write the document in Lanky, the author was effectively encoding it, making it almost impossible for anyone but himself to actually make sense of the text. Quite why this degree of secrecy was necessary can only be a matter of fruitless speculation. Was the text banned, illegal, stolen, or confidential? Or was it something Rutland needed to hide from his captors or even his colleagues? In a fascinating, albeit largely speculative article published in the Hebridean in 1967, the criminologist Dame Belinda Hacking thought that this was probably the case. Referencing certain scraps of paper that even the redoubtable F.A.F. Hogan was unable to place with any certainty in the final poem, she surmised that the work was, in fact, ultimately a description of the location of a lost treasure. Some of the largely unintelligible scripts F.A.F. Hogan excluded from her final version of the work included parts of words that could be associated with gold and relics and possible place names. Dame Belinda's conjecture is that the work is actually, in part, a description for the recovery of lost treasure, hidden during the medieval times and never recovered. And indeed, unless and until the lost final critical works are found, it is likely to remain hidden. If this is true, she states, it is hardly surprising that Rutland wished to keep the whole thing secret. We do not know. Indeed, from this end of history, we cannot know. All that is really relevant is that the text was unreadable. Only Rutland could make sense of it. Graphology. We know that Rutland could both read and write in English from annotations clearly made by him on some of the other documents that ended up in the Buchanan Smith archive. A graphology study conducted in Winchester in 1934 by Dr. James Kennedy and Dr. Corin Draw on all the archive's documentations conclusively demonstrated that the text of The Jungle was written by Rutland. reassembling a puzzle. Establishing the order and meaning of the manuscript proved to be a lengthy task. Mockett had the document translated into standard English by mid-1934, since when, of course, there have been several other literal translations, the most famous of which is that of Dr. F.A.F. Hogan's, published in 1962 by the revivalist Latimer Press in St. Martin's. This publication, however, whilst of use to scholars, does not capture in modern English the rhyme or metre used in the original manuscript, but it does provide an exact translation copy of the 137 pieces of often damaged and in some places indecipherable parchment that made up the work. That the manuscript was fragmented into quite so many pieces, with no readily available contents guide to help establish the order of the papers, presented a great challenge. It is undoubtedly F.A.F. Hogan's greatest contribution that she was ultimately able to make a continuous sense of it all. Her work, of the arrangement of pieces, most of which were written down with, it first appears, random design across the page, and almost entirely without punctuation, has only slightly been amended since by other scholars. The most relevant of these works is that done by Dr. Rockingham Gill at Lampeter University. Where there are contradictions, I have selected to use those set out by Dr. Rockingham Gill, who, working with the benefit of infrared technology many years later, was able to discern discrepancies and connections invisible to the naked eye. The actual arrangements of text on parchment was itself unconventional, as if swimming in a large sea, or perhaps as if they'd been jotted down by a writer not looking too closely at how he wrote what he did. Writing style. The actual arrangement of text on parchment was itself unconventional, as if swimming in a large sea, or perhaps as if they had been jotted down by a writer not looking too closely at how he wrote what he did. My own surmise is that this is more than possible. When someone is writing something, they do not, in all instances, pay too much attention to how they write what they do, when copying, for example. I will come back to this possibility later. F.A.F. Hogan's painstaking study effectively put back together a large and complicated linguistic jigsaw, and almost all of the layout of the words in the decision follows Hogan's published summary, the lines, spaces, gaps, and paragraphs. To make better sense of narrative, I have added in the most obviously missing parts of punctuation, without which it would be hard to make sense of many of the lines. For this, I make no apology, but I have been greatly helped in the task by the grammarians Dr. Persephone Kenton and Professor Timothy Ward at Bristol and Dr. Lotten Vanholm. In preparing this work for publication, it has also been my sole objective to make the text as easy to read and as relevant for the current age as I can. Certainly there will be some who dissent from the wisdom of doing this, but my mission is not a scholarly one. To achieve maximum readability, I have revised a substantial number of words, using wherever possible 21st century alternatives, in order to provide a smooth reading experience, unencumbered by footnotes and linguistic explanations. For help in this task, I am indebted to Dr. Penny McCoy-Silver and her team at the Oxford English Dictionary. At every point, my objective has been to provide the manuscript with all the necessary apparatus as if to permit it the most widespread readership across the most typical book lovers, a task not of simplification, but of clarification. The title. The work itself came without any title, but it has over time been given the sobriquet of The Jungle, as much because of its opening and ending lines as for the greater themes it appears to cover. It is for that reason I have selected to retain this title in presenting the work. The titles of the 16 different sections are, of course, the ones given by F.A.F. Hogan to make stronger sense of the content of each part. In the section for Section 7, Loose Ends, I have selected an alternative title, later proposed by Lady Beckett, who conducted her own compelling appraisal of the text in 1984-5 at the Ryde Department of Continuing Education in the Isle of Wight. But we know that there are missing sections too. In fact, there seem to be 8 in total that are completely missing. That is, if the current selection, 16, is the last selection. Of course, there may well have been more sections and selections, but we are unlikely to ever know this. It is therefore impossible to state with any certainty that section 16 was the final section of the work. Perhaps others await discovery. The original manuscripts included numbers from which it is possible to discern some of the missing sections. Authorship. But was Rutland the original author? From the start, Mockett did not think so, though certainly it is clear that Rutland was the written author. But if Rutland Authorship. But was Rutland the original author? From the start, Mockett did not think so, though certainly it seems clear that Rutland was the original author. For fuck's sake. Authorship. But was Rutland the original author? From the start, Mockett didn't think so, though certainly it's clear that Rutland was the written author. But if Rutland compiled or transcribed the document, what made Professor Mockett and others so certain he was not its original author? Thankfully, there are clues. Several parts of the manuscript, 13 in all, include the phrase given as, a phrase common at the time to denote a statement that had been provided to a writer. 27 other such fragments have been included that indicate place names beneath, below, or alongside the text, written in Dutch, and with one or two exceptions, all untraceable to known maps of the time, indicating most probably a source. This, of course, begs the question whether the work is that of a single author. Textual analysis of the vocabulary indicates that this is indeed so, or likely to be so. It is unlikely that it can ever be proved now one way or the other. But it appears that the tone, vocabulary, and grammatical structures used in the manuscript represent the work of a single person. For corroboration of this, there are several people I must thank, most notably Mark De La Torre, professor, and his team at the University of Gloucestershire, Dr. George Miller at UCL, and the Oxford lexicographer, Mrs. Susie Dent. That this person was probably not Rutland is supported by the annotations Rutland himself made from time to time, as if he were copying out sections of a large document. Certainly, with his long incarceration in Kandy, that this person was not Rutland is supported by the annotations Rutland himself made from time to time, as if he were copying out sections of a large document. Certainly, with his long imprisonment in Kandy, he would have more than enough time to do this. And it is therefore for this reason that I have taken the decision to issue the work without a given author, to let it stand alone simply as a written document. We do not know who wrote it. We only know that it was most probably not Rutland. Whether this document constitutes poetry, historical observation, religious or philosophical prophecy seems to be beside the point. It is what it is. I do not believe that it requires a literary label to make it more or less readable. More relevant, perhaps, is to weigh up the likely period and the places it describes. This is a much simpler task. It is clear from section 2 that what is being described is an island. What survives is that perfect island, presented in the way a child might dream of an island. That this island is most likely to be Ceylon, now present-day Sri Lanka, is evident not simply from the provenance of the manuscript, but from the text itself. In one section, Adam's Bridge, the chain of islands that links India to Sri Lanka, is clearly defined. A single shattered path remains, holding the island to the outside world on sunken limestone banks racked by cyclones, reduced year on year till it is cast adrift. More specifically, only Sri Lanka has such an exact set of natural gemstones as described in section 2. Pink sapphires and rubies, garnets, topazes, aquamarines, rose quartz fine enough to see through. The customs the same section describes, the respect paid to older people by touching their feet, the puberty rites of girls, and the birthing rituals, new babies are fed on milk dipped in gold, were and in some places still are common in Southeast Asia, Sri Lanka included. The singing fish sang off long sandy beaches, is a well-known Sri Lankan phenomenon from Batticola, and one that, extraordinarily, may actually be true according to the work done there by American missionaries and their recording equipment in the 1950s. The reference to lagoons links up with Sri Lanka's many famous lagoons, the most significant of which is the Puttalam Lagoon on the west coast. The reference in section 3 to southern ports is most likely thought to refer to the ancient port of Godavappa in present-day Hambantota, of shipping lanes that converged on southern ports. The reference to irrigation tanks, and specifically island seas, is most probably a reference to the Sea of Prabhakara, a vast reservoir in Pulunurua, constructed by the king in 386 CE and is still in use today. Water rippled in great tanks built by kings like inland seas to flow to fields and homes. The references to three coup leaders, coup being examples of one of the many words I've introduced or altered from the original to make the narrative obviously less ancient, could refer to a number of different periods in Sri Lankan history. One strong probability is the Dravidian period of 101 BCE, which saw successive kings kill one another. Another is the later reigns of the Vijayan dynasty from 31 CE, when King Abhaya was murdered by his brother Tissa, who was in turn most likely killed by King Abhaya's son Juluba, whose death 3 years later introduced a state of extreme lawlessness. An almost exact set of circumstances occurred later in 246 CE, triggered by the death of King Sirinaga II. The links are manifold to northern temples, to gods. The links are manifold to northern temples, to gods who cure maladies and fevers, to stupas and pilgrims travelling up a hill or mountain, Adam's Peak, the king's lofty citadel, Sigiriya. Indeed, the text is so littered with references of this kind as to make it impossible for it to describe anything other than Sri Lanka. Even so, I am indebted to Dr. Ranjani Gunatilika at the Society of Surveying and Mapping, Mr. Pereira and Mr. Moligona at the Surveyor General's Department, and Mr. Ivo at the Land Registry for their invaluable help in helping me determine how many questions relating to place names in Sri Lanka should be answered in order to get an accurate and definitive idea of its links to the island. For readers interested in following more closely a number of associations, I've attached some notes at the back of the book to give a greater level of detail for some of the events, people, places, fauna and flora covered in the original text. What is it? Rutland's given work most likely describes a series of historical events over a possibly very wide period of time, most likely ancient or early medieval, that occurred in what is today the island of Sri Lanka. The work is quite evidently more than just a historical recollection. It is filled at every turn with the author's own peculiar and inescapable perspective. The anonymous author outlines a fearful jungle wilderness tamed by kings and then destroyed, an earthly paradise that imploded through civil unrest and invasion, leading to the complete breakdown of an ancient civilization that was subsumed again by the jungle to a point where its present inhabitants had only the sketchiest recollections of its past. Amidst the ruins of a greater past, the current inhabitants live out their plain lives with little hope of redemption. This story structure is readily recognisable as an archetypal fable or parable of the kind that underwrites countless narratives, poems or fictions. Indeed, it permeates into official histories and certainly mythologies, old and new. It is a typical story of the rise and fall of civilization and man himself, in part a sort of Sri Lankan Lord of the Rings, albeit, without scholars think, the ring. This must necessarily count as one of the most popular subject matters ever selected by authors. The search for an earthly paradise, wrote Dr. Hilary Mitchell, in the Highgate Journal of Thematic Philology, is a classic literary modus operandi, an essential plot mechanism that underwrites most of the written words from the Epic of Gilgamesh to Five on Treasure Island. Parables like this are to be found in a myriad of other much more famous and better written texts, from the Holy Land to the ancient world, from the civilizations of South and Central America to China, from Middle Earth to the fables of Bo, or any number of book categories on Amazon.com. Its value today lies simply in its reading, purporting to be none of these things, but merely a kind of modest tale from the hands of a single anonymous man who believed in exactly this kind of parable. Indeed, were it not for the work of earlier scholars, it would have amounted to nothing at all. I do not attempt to provide a commentary on or a judgment over the actual work. That is a task that each and every reader will come to themselves. The title of the work, The Jungle, and other subsections are, of course, entirely missing from the original manuscript, being useful shorthand introduced along the way by scholars trying to get to grips with the puzzle. I have retained them, for all they offer is a simple and direct point of access to comprehend the work, and I have found it impossible to better. And finally, a word of thanks to the staff and directors of the Flame Tree Estate and Hotel, whose kind and indulgent hospitality I have enjoyed whilst on location to research aspects of the work. Max De Silva, Marshall College, 2020.
That was a production of Poetry from the Jungle from the Salon Press.